please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In Britain, former Cabinet Minister Michael Gove says he does not expect to return to front bench politics as he backs the underdog in the race for a new Prime Minister. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's political correspondent Peter Walker. The piece is titled "Gove Backs Sunak and Says Truss is Taking Holiday from Reality." In Britain, former Cabinet Minister Michael Gove has thrown his support behind Rishi Sunak in the Conservative leadership contest, warning that Liz Truss's refusal to offer more support over rising energy bills and to just focus on tax cuts marked a holiday from reality. In a sometimes hard-hitting article in The Times, Michael Gove said he did not expect to be made a minister again, and that many people expected Liz Truss to win, but he believes Rishi Sunak makes the right arguments. Arguing that millions of people and huge numbers of businesses could be financially crippled by high energy costs, Michael Gove wrote that it was vital the new government had a coherent economic plan. "And here I am deeply concerned that the framing of the leadership debate by many has been a holiday from reality," he said. The answer to the cost of living crisis cannot be simply to reject further handouts and cut tax, he wrote, a reference to Liz Truss's insistence that she would reduce national insurance contributions and resist most forms of direct help. "Proposed cuts to national insurance would favour the wealthy, and changes to corporation tax apply to big businesses, not small entrepreneurs. I cannot see how safeguarding the stock options of FTSE 100 executives should ever take precedence over supporting the poorest in our society. But at a time of want, it cannot be the right priority." Michael Gove added, "In contrast, I believe Rishi Sunak makes the right arguments." The endorsement of the former Community Secretary Michael Gove, a Conservative big hitter who has spent over a decade in the Cabinet under David Cameron, Theresa May and Boris Johnson, will be a blow to Liz Truss, even if it is unlikely to revive Rishi Sunak's campaign. Michael Gove had initially endorsed Kemi Badenoch, with whom he worked in the Communities Department, but who was knocked out as MPs whittled the field to contenders down to the final two. Saying Liz Truss, who was a junior minister with him in the education department, is tenacious, brave, and has a huge appetite for policy detail, Michael Gove said she had also been admirably clear, consistent, and principled in the case that she has made during the leadership race. He went on, But I do not think her prospectus is the right answer for the world that we face. It does not address the fundamental problems of potential neglected, productivity suppressed, and the vulnerable suffering the most. In endorsing Rishi Sunak, Michael Gove is less likely to win a place in Liz Truss's cabinet, despite his experience and his record as a trusted minister. "I do not expect to be in the government again," Michael Gove wrote. "But it was the privilege of my life to spend 11 years in the cabinet under three prime ministers. I know what the job requires, and Rishi Sunak has it." Liz Truss, meanwhile, has been accused of holding up publication of the Foreign Office's annual human rights report because it is likely to contain criticisms of Rwanda's human rights record. This year's version of the annual assessment of how the United Kingdom views other countries' human rights records was due before the parliamentary summer recess and is now the most delayed report since the review was launched by the then Foreign Secretary Robin Cook 21 years ago. Critics say the impasse could be an attempt to quash criticism of Rwanda, to which the government wants to deport migrants and asylum seekers, or because Liz Truss is focused on the Conservative leadership race, where she is the clear favourite over Rishi Sunak. Rishi Sunak insisted on Thursday, 18th of August, he still has a shot of being Prime Minister, despite a new opinion poll saying Liz Truss has a 32 percentage point lead as the contest enters its final fortnight. The YouGov opinion poll with Sky News found Liz Truss had 66% of members backing her, with 34% backing Rishi Sunak, excluding don't-knows. The former Chancellor sought to reinvigorate his campaign with another flurry of policy announcements centred around a plan to improve the National Health Service dental services, including a programme of early intervention checkups in primary schools. During the leadership contest, Liz Truss has said she supports and would extend the controversial Rwanda policy. Court papers arising from proceedings to block the plan have showed that the UK's High Commissioner to Rwanda warned against the scheme because the nation has been accused of recruiting refugees to conduct armed operations in neighbouring countries. The delayed Foreign Office human rights report would be expected to include further criticisms of Rwanda. The last edition, published in July of 2021, said that critical voices continued to face heavy restrictions in the country. It also condemned the death in police custody of a reconciliation activist, Kizito Mihigo.
Welcome back. We met Javad Qarai, an enthusiastic young nature explorer, and followed him as he discovered some of Iran's most unspoiled natural attractions in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. We visited the exotic Martian mountains with their peculiar shapes and ventured deep into the intertwining and spiral cave of the region. And finally, we joined Javad as he gazed into the mesmerizing waters of the Sea of Oman above the rocky cliffs. Stay with us as we further explore the wonders of the region and meet the kind-hearted locals.
The area is so beautiful and unspoiled It is home to large flocks of birds, such as the cormorant sitting on the sandy beaches offering a scenic spectacle. It is the perfect place for bird watchers to come and feast their eyes on these exotic animals. Bird watching is a branch of tourism, or to be exact, ecotourism. Bird watchers are steadily growing in number. Cormorants are aquatic birds. They are medium to large in size, with a body weight in the range of 0.35 to 5 kilograms and a wingspan of 45 to 100 centimeters. The majority of the species have dark feathers. They are excellent divers, and underwater, they propel themselves with their feet with help from their wings. Some cormorant species have been found to dive as deep as 45 meters. Cormorants nest in colonies around the shore, on trees, islets, or cliffs. They are coastal rather than oceanic birds, and some have colonized inland waters. Indeed, the original ancestor of cormorants seems to have been a freshwater bird. In my previous trips here, I saw large flocks of these beautiful birds here in this season. But this time, there aren't so many of them. One of the reasons behind the decline in their populations is because some of the locals hunt and eat them. Although cormorants are not supposed to be eaten because they are carnivorous. According to some religious scholars, flesh-eating birds are not to be eaten. The flesh of carnivorous birds may contain many diseases that can be passed on to humans if eaten, but the locals are not aware of that. Those who hunt the cormorants do not do so because there is nothing else to eat, so they have no reason to kill and consume so many of these poor birds and do irreparable damage to the wildlife and environment in the region. The environment and wildlife are manifestations of God's beauty. How can humans, who consider themselves the greatest of creations, allow themselves to harm the manifestations of God's beauty? Human survival on the planet Earth inevitably depends on the environment and on the wildlife. Therefore, our country's officials should educate the local populations and make sure that the environment in each and every part of the country is well taken care of. This has been a very beautiful day for me. Barrie East is one of the most beautiful places I have visited, and I have visited many over the years. A day later, I'm on my way to a beautiful village in the heart of nature, accompanied by my good friend, Sheer Muhammad Rahul. To get to Shaam-e-Kohne, that's the name of the village, we have to walk a relatively long way surrounded by beautiful natural beauties. Near the village, we run into a shepherd named Sheer Muhammad, sitting under an old leafless tree by a pond. His is the simplest of lifestyles. The Baluch mainly speak the Baluchi language, a branch of northwestern Iranian languages. Experts say the Baluch language is very similar to that of the Medes, a people of Indo-Iranian origin, who inhabited the western and northwestern portion of present-day Iran. And that is a testimony to the deep roots of the Baluch tribe in Iran. Today, the Baluch people live in the southwest of Iran, the south of Pakistan, Afghanistan, Oman, India, the UAE, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Zanzibar. Borders between countries haven't been able to separate members of this ancient Iranian tribe. Although they live in different countries, the Baluch have preserved their traditions. They pay each other visits, and intertribal marriages are common. The Shahnameh and several other old books have placed the dwelling place of the Baluch people at around the north of modern-day Khorasan province. For various reasons, this peace-loving, serene tribe have had to move here, the southeast of Iran, and lived in peace since. Shir Muhammad Baluch is one of the original members of the old Sham village. But today, the village is nothing more than a collection of abandoned buildings where he can rest during sizzling hot days. This is amazing. They place one lantern and both families lived under the light of that one lantern. There isn't much left of the old Sham village, but even the ruins of it speak of the very rich culture of the kind, hospitable Baluch people. One of the structures that has stood the test of time is the beautiful mosque of Old Sham, built by the very hands of those who inhabited the village many years ago. It's gotten unbearably hot by now. I am kilometers away from the coast of the Sea of Oman in Baluchistan. But that distance is not going to keep me from a much-needed dive on the golden sand beach. The difference between the temperatures in Iran's climate zones is incredible, and to many, unbelievable. I'm in the southeasternmost part of Iran, swimming in the Sea of Oman in the middle of winter. On this same day, some of my mountaineer friends climbing up Mount Damavand tell me the temperature where they are is around minus 30 degrees. That's a difference of 60 degrees between two areas of Iran. I've done my swimming, and now I've decided to travel to the southeastern end of Iranian territory. That's the Gwadar Bay, located in the Gulf of Oman on the maritime border of Iran and Pakistan. A lot of fish is caught and brought to shore here. Many large trawler launches unload their catches on smaller boats on the shore. Before they arrive in Iranian territory, the fish coming from those launches are purchased by middlemen and transported to big cities around the country. The main purpose of my trip to Guadar Bay is to see the beautiful Hara mangrove forest in this border area. Hara is a species of the Lantana genus. The seeds from the tree fall into the water, where wave action takes them to more stationary parts of the sea. The Hara seeds become fixed in the soil layers of the sea and grow. Hara trees are saltwater plants that are often submerged at high tide. They are salt-tolerant trees and are adapted to life in harsh coastal conditions. They contain a complex salt filtration system and a complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. They are adapted to the low oxygen conditions of waterlogged mud. We are now exactly at the mouth of Khure Bahu. This is the zero point that separates Iran from Pakistan. We are about to enter a very beautiful river. As a matter of fact, it's a khur or firth, it's not a river. And it continues a long way in that direction. Khure Bahu is in fact a bay area created by water from the Sea of Oman. This is the last spot before you actually arrive in the sea itself. Before the firth, there is the Bahu Kalat River that flows from Sarbaz Mountains to the Gulf of Oman. This is it. I can see the mountains of Pakistan vividly from here. Pakistan is located right on the other side of the Hara Forest. A lot of birds and fish live here in this firth, which, as I said, was created by salty waters from the Sea of Oman. It's a very beautiful area. The Hara forests spanning this area are indeed unique. The Hara tree grows to heights of 6 meters and has bright green leaves and twigs. It is a species of the mangrove tree that can grow in coastal saline or brackish water. They have a complex salt filtration system and complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. The Hara excludes salt by having significantly impermeable roots, which are highly impregnated with suberin, acting as an ultrafiltration mechanism to exclude sodium salts from the rest of the plant. Hara trees grow in 8 protected areas in Iran and are fortunately looked after by both the authorities and people. The Hara forests in the south of Iran are a major habitat for migratory birds in the cold season and for reptiles, fish, and varieties of bivalves. Green or hooked turtles and venomous aquatic snakes are also indigenous to the forests. Bird life includes herons, flamingos, pelicans, and angler eagles. Another important feature of these forests is the appropriate and suitable seabed conditions for the ovulation of fish in the Persian Gulf. The locals say you are very likely to run into a school of dolphins passing Guadar Bay on your way to see the Hara forests. But looks like I'm down on my luck today. There are still many villages in Baluchistan that have weathered the storm of time and preserved their traditional look. But the way to visit one of them is to seek guidance from a local guide. And that person is none other than my very own friend, Shir Muhammad. We have a long way ahead of us to the village we have decided to visit. To get there, we have to drive on a vast plain. There are no paved roads, not so much as a dirt track. The name of the village is Nilag. Baluchistan is a very dry province. It rains very little here. As a result, not very long ago, the people of Baluchistan would dig a catchment to accumulate what little rainwater that fell from the sky. Those catchments acted as their only water reservoirs. They called them hotags. The importance of drinking water is not lost on anyone nowadays. Aware of the shortage of this vital liquid, countries around the world have embarked on preserving and conserving drinking water in recent years. The best way to prevent water from going to waste in a country like Iran that's facing a severe water problem is changing the consumption pattern. Put it simply, every human being needs only 10 liters of water to wash their whole body. But most of us keep the water running while having a shower and let something between 100 and 200 liters of precious drinking water go into the septic tank. Nowadays, most of us think that to keep our yards clean, we have to wash them with tap water every week. While in the past, although the problem of water was not as serious in Iran as it is now, and the population was not as big, people would clean their yards with sprinkles of water and a broom. And the purpose was to prevent dust from rising when sweeping. In the past, there weren't as many cars that needed to be washed with drinking water every few days. But today, millions of liters of water is consumed every year to wash the millions of vehicles across the country. I came to realize the importance of drinking water in recent years. On one of my trips to this same Baluchistan region, I ended up bathing with only 3 liters of water after going without a wash for a whole week. It was a time when the people here were grappling with a drought. That incident led me to understand the importance of drinking water in Iran. I now understand why we shouldn't let even a single drop of it go to waste. This is one of the oldest houses in this whole area. In this whole village. And Haji Khodabakhsh was in fact born in this same house. He's giving me a tour of the interior. The houses in the village of Nilag are beautiful and traditional. But there is one house in this village that is very old, very beautiful, and unique. In Baluchi language, this house is called a kud. It is dark in the house. There is no electricity, no running water, and not even a room. This is all there is to it. The owner says that all the members of the family, and there were 9 of them, used to live together in this house that is no more than one big lounge. But despite all the deprivations, the members of the family are as close as ever. The Baluch are a very kind, family-loving people. I feel an eerie feeling of calm among these pure souls. Baluch hospitality makes any stranger visiting these parts feel at home in their houses. You feel like you were born and raised in one of these houses and lived a good, simple life growing up with these genial and warm people. Most of the Baluch people who don't go fishing at sea are herders, and in this area, camels are the best livestock to keep. Camels have adapted very well to the environment and climate of Baluchistan. My journey is coming to an end. Sheer Muhammad tells me about one of his friends. Mr. Shah Bakhsh is one of the main camel herders in the region. The old camel rider tells me about Baluch kindness towards all of the world's creatures. Kindness embedded in the culture of this people. The Baluch are a very kind and passionate people, traits that are evident in the words of Mr. Shah Bakhsh. When I ask him if he's ever tried camel meat, he says the Baluch normally do not eat camel. That's because camels are loved by these people, and so they don't have the heart to slaughter them, much less eat their meat. I have arrived at the end of my trip, a trip that taught me many valuable lessons about the Baluch people and Baluchistan. This is a province with a beautiful, unspoiled environment. A place where the sea meets the mountains and plains. The Baluch people, with their rich ancient culture, are a source of great pride for Iran. I too am proud of these honest, kind people. Proud of having such generous fellow countrymen and women. The Sea of Oman looks like a drop of water against the unfathomable hearts of these people. All I want for the people here is proper, stable jobs compatible with their culture and environment created by competent and caring government officials. I hope for facilities and development to come to this part of my country without doing any damage to its ancient culture and pristine environment.
Well, perhaps Iran's internationally renowned mosques and ancient remnants of Isfahan and Shiraz are what attracts most visitors from far and wide, but I'm sure many nature-loving individuals have become interested in visiting Iran's southernmost region and the pristine natural wonders of Sistan and Baluchistan. And that's it for this week, everyone. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on January 23, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha.
A hay'at is a social unit and institution that pivots around love for the household of the Prophet. A person who has a question should not think that everything is upside down. No, his question should be asked, and that's all right. The answer should be provided in hay'ats, in centers of knowledge and understanding. This is the meaning and essence of hay'ats. As for dynamism and movement, this means benefiting from art and face-to-face dialogues. The difference between your art and many other forms of art is that you face your audience directly. You speak to your audience and they communicate their feelings to you. In other words, you are in contact with one another in a reciprocal, direct relationship. This is the dynamism of the hay'ats. Another form of dynamism is forming daste in the streets, where groups of mourners walk in the streets, in the alleys and in the markets. As a talented brother of ours said, the daste for Imam Hussein are in fact a symbol of Imam Hussein's journey from Mecca to Karbala. His was a movement of jihad and a movement on the path of Allah. The next point about hay'ats is the struggle, jihad, for clarification, as I mentioned before.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
So the Hay'ats rely on struggle. What does this struggle mean? Jihad or struggle means an effort and endeavor made to confront the enemy. Not every effort is jihad. Many people make an effort. For example, they make scientific and economic efforts, which are good, but they are not an act of jihad. Jihad means an effort that targets the enemy. This is jihad. In Islamic terminology and in Islamic logic, jihad is an action that is taken to confront the enemy. If you do economic work to confront the enemy, it is an act of jihad. If you do scientific research work to confront the enemy, this is an act of jihad. If you speak out and clarify matters to counteract the enemy's temptations, this is an act of jihad. All of these are jihadi acts. So the important point is that we should identify the fields for jihad in every era. This is very important. We should not make a mistake in identifying the enemy. I have frequently given the following example. Some people fall asleep in a trench at the front and wake up after some time. They do not know where the enemy is and where their fellow soldiers are. So they may point their gun at their own friends. Sometimes this happens. Some people do not know what the fields for jihad are. They do not know where they should go, where the enemy is, which way they should look, and what the target should be. This is what is important.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
In the limelight.
For decades, the CIA conducted highly unethical experiments on humans in order to perfect brainwashing, mind control, and torture techniques. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kate Klannenberg, investigative journalist. This article is published under the heading New Research Finds CIA Used Black Americans as Drugs Experiment Guinea Pigs. Here's more. By now, many will be familiar with Project MKUltra. For decades, the CIA conducted highly unethical experiments on humans in order to protect brainwashing, mind control, and torture techniques. Perhaps the program's most notorious aspect was the administration of high doses of psychoactive drugs to target, particularly LSD. These substances were brought to Lange's attention in 1948 by Richard Kahn, one of 1,600 Nazi scientists covertly spirited to U.S. via Operation Paperclip following the Second World War. When MKUltra was formally established 5 years later, some individuals consulted directly on the project. The unwitting dosing of U.S. citizens with LSD is infamous. Among those spiked were CIA operatives themselves. That the agency exploited mental patients, prisoners, and drug addicts for the purpose. People who could not fight back, in the words of an unnamed agency operative, is less well known. A study by academics at the University of Ottawa's Culture and Mental Health Disparities Lab sheds significant new light on this underexplored component of MKUltra and illuminates a hitherto wholly unknown dimension of the program. People of color, overwhelmingly Black Americans, were disproportionately targeted by the CIA in its service. In 1973, due to fears CIA covert action might be officially audited in the wake of the Watergate scandal, then-agency chief Richard Hems ordered all papers related to MKUltra destroyed. Tens of thousands of documents somehow survived the purge. Even more conveniently, a significant portion of the research yielded by the project's experiments was published in freely accessible, peer-reviewed scientific journals. As over 80 private and public universities, prisons, and hospitals, whether knowingly or not, conducted psychedelic drug experiments on behalf of the CIA. While LSD was the preponderant substance of interest, the effects of DMT, mescaline, psilocybin, and THC were also extensively explored. In all, the University of Ottawa team analyzed 49 of these papers, published from 1950s to 1970s. 40% related to experiments conducted at the Addiction Research Center in Kentucky, which the CIA directly managed. The site included a prison for individuals charged with violating narcotics laws, a special ward for drug research, and a prison populated by purported addicts. Researchers employed there avowedly preferred to perform tests on former and current drug users, as they were considered to be experienced in the effects of illicit substances and therefore better able to give informed consent than the abstinent. In practice, the CIA's guinea pigs frequently had no idea what was being administered. In analyzing available literature, the academics examined participants' stated race and ethnicity, recruitment strategies, methodology, and potential dangers to participants. All studies used captured incarcerated test subjects, coercive incentives for participation, unsafe dosing levels, and had questionable scientific merit. In almost 90% of cases, at least one ethical violation was identified. Over three-quarters employed a high-risk dosing schedule that would be unacceptable under modern guidelines, and 15% used participants with psychotic disorders. Roughly 30% exploited people of color. While in many studies, the race or ethnicity of test subjects was not recorded, further investigation by Ottawa academics revealed Black Americans were significantly overrepresented in the recruitment sites from which test subjects were drawn. It is inevitable that the actual number of MKUltra studies that abuse people of color is far larger. For example, while people of color constituted just 7% of Kentucky's population at a time of experiments at the Addiction Research Center, Black and Mexican Americans represented 66% of the site's inmate population. In any event, that people of color suffered to a far greater degree than white test subjects at the proverbial hands of the CIA is starkly set forth in the experiment's blood-curdling details. For instance, a 1957 study records how numerous vulnerable individuals were psychologically and physically tortured, in particular one black participant who was described by researchers as if he were an animal and treated accordingly. Dosed with LSD, he exhibited a wild, frightened look and asked for medicines to relieve his fear. Their purpose was to place him in restraints and administer a further cocktail of drugs at far higher doses than other participants, whose race was not recorded, and to continue doing so against his will. Similarly, the previous year, an experiment was conducted in which black participants were given 180 micrograms of LSD each day for 85 days, while white participants received 75 micrograms each day over just 8 days. One black subject had a very severe reaction to their dosage and asked to drop out of the study once they had recovered. After considerable persuasion, however, they agreed to continue. Undue influence was a recurrent theme identified by the academics across the papers analyzed. A variety of coercive techniques were frequently employed to solicit and maintain participation in brutal and at times life-threatening examinations. For example, addiction research center inmates were offered a choice of reduced substances or drugs such as heroin in return for volunteering. These drugs could be taken upon completion of a study or saved in a bank account for subsequent withdrawals. Test subjects almost always chose to feed their addictions rather than get out of prison earlier.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Shuttered stations and picket lines. Another day of severe disruption in the British capital.
We're just outside an underground station in West London, usually a very busy station, but today it is closed. The same thing or very limited service across many different stations in London for 24 hours.
It comes a day after another mass walkout of railway workers. The advice from the authorities, avoid traveling on the tube if possible.
I'm with them because it's true. When you're 60, why should you retire? I mean, why should they give you redundancy?
I mean, the cost of living is going up and all that. They're asking for a fair thing. Same in any job. They're offering silly things like 3% when inflation now is 10%. So I'm fully behind them.
I understand the people. That's normal. They are workers, they need more money, of course, everything is rising.
A major bus walkout will also affect travel in parts of the capital. While a second day of rail strikes is expected to disrupt services around the country on Saturday. Almost all are part of widespread stoppages in recent months organized mainly by the National Union of Railway, Maritime and Transport Workers, locked in a face-off with the government over modernizing changes, wages and pensions, among other things.
People in this country are fed up with low pay. Many millions of people have had not a proper pay deal for a decade. So public sector workers in healthcare, education, transport, all sorts of services have been subjected to pay cuts and rampant inflation.
The ongoing strikes are inspiring other public sector workers, such as nurses and teachers, to do the same in the face of rampant inflation forecast to top 13% this year.
In the next few months, you're bound to see a convergence of trade unions all taking very direct action, calling their members on strike in an effort to protect the cost of living increases and the deterioration of wages that we've seen for workers across the country.
The government has threatened to use emergency powers to block future strikes. The unions, on the other hand, say they're not relenting unless they receive new deals they deem acceptable. Saeed Purizza, London.
Turkish main opposition party CHP has criticized the government for, quote, its double standards in regards with the Palestinian cause. The reaction was made after Turkey announced that it will appoint an ambassador to Israel, 4 years after Ankara cut its ties with the regime over the killing of 60 Palestinians by Israeli forces during a protest on the Gaza border. Deputy chairman of CHP parliamentary bloc Engin Özkoç said, it seems the AKP has not heard about Israel's latest aggression in Gaza, adding the government has forgotten its promises to Palestinians.
Erdogan used to describe Israel as a child killer and a terrorist regime. Since the Marmara incident in 2010, Erdogan set conditions for normalizing relations with Israel. Those conditions weren't met, but what has changed now? Israel's killing of Palestinian children continues and has not stopped. A week ago, Palestinian children were killed in Gaza by Israel. Hasn't AKP heard about Israel's killing of children in Gaza in the latest Israeli attack? And now, they are rushing to normalize relations with Israel? They deal with the file in two different ways, and they have forgotten their promises to the Palestinians and our people as well.
Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu said, Turkey is not giving up on the Palestinian cause. However, it is important for their messages to be conveyed directly through the ambassadors. For the past few months, Turkey and Israel have been trying to normalize ties. Back in March, they announced a new era in their relations after the Israeli president paid a visit to Ankara and met Erdogan. Turkish people have always criticized the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian land. They have repeatedly taken to the streets to protest against the Israeli aggression in the Gaza Strip. While anti-Israeli sentiment runs high in Turkey, analysts say Ankara's whole foreign policy is changing, with this normalization being part of a new political strategy taken by the Erdogan administration. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Another mass walkout bringing the UK's railway network to a grinding halt, causing major disruptions. Tens of thousands of signalers, maintenance workers, ticket collectors fighting for their rights as negotiations with the government for better pay and conditions hit the buffers.
I support the workers that are striking.
We're being inconvenienced, but they're being treated unequally.
Many rail employees, often working unsocial hours in a high-pressure environment, say they have seen no pay rise in 3 years, as the specter of soaring inflation, predicted to surpass 13% over the next year, looms over negotiations. The Conservative government has offered a below-inflation pay rise and accuses the unions organizing the strikes of taking the country for ransom. Despite that, public support for the strikes is on the rise.
I'm quite sympathetic to the train strikes. They're actually the other industrial unrest, because it comes on the back of minimal increase in wages over a long period of time, a pay freeze much more recently, and an offer which is frankly way, way, way below the current rate of inflation.
Stoking the public ire, comments by Conservative Prime Ministerial hopeful Liz Truss, who has pledged to restrict the ability of public sector workers to strike.
Liz Truss is seeking to take away human rights and the ability of the democratic right of people to express themselves through their trade unions and industrial action, which is one of the pillars of our democracy. It's only repressive regimes that stop people going on strike and stop them expressing themselves and stop them rebalancing the power in the workplace through their trade unions.
The opposition Labour Party, which receives funding from several trade unions itself, has also come under fire for failing to support the walkouts. The rail strikes, which also include London's underground and overground network, have set off a wave of industrial action that is set to get bigger, with teachers, health workers, and even barristers planning their own strikes.
Britain's so-called summer of discontent seems well underway, with a general strike more likely now than ever before, and with the railway workers in the eye of the storm. Saeed Pereza, London.
The Israeli military shut down seven Palestinian non-governmental civil society and human rights organizations in the occupied West Bank. Early on Thursday, the Israeli military raided occupied Ramallah and broke into the offices of the organizations. The offices were ransacked and their equipment confiscated. Doors were welded shut with an Israeli military order posted on them declaring the organizations unlawful. The groups have decried the move as politically motivated and baseless.
They are targeting by the seven organizations. They are targeting the civil society sector in Palestine and the human rights sector in general. So the message was, any organization talked about expose the Israeli policy, talked about the Israeli crimes will be targeted and will be silent. Again, the message also for the international organizations and, of course, also for the EU states, those who are rejected the Israeli allegation against the organizations. This is a message that Israel is above the law.
Israel has outlawed six of these NGOs, which were labeled as terrorist organizations in October 2021, and accused them of funneling donor aid to militants and had ties to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a Palestinian left-wing movement. The organizations that have been outlawed by Israel are Ad-Damir and Al-Haq, which document human rights violations, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, Bissan Center for Research, DCI, Defense for Children International Palestine, as well as the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. The seventh organization was the Union of Health Work Committees.
We will continue our work. Work in this field, it's not a job. It's not a job. The Israelis continue their atrocities, their oppression against us, against the rest of the civil society organizations here. But this will not stop us, and this will not push us back, and we will not give up, and we will continue. We know that we pay price, maybe personal price, maybe different kind of a price, but we are ready to defend, to fight for the principles that we do believe.
The United Nations Human Rights Office has meanwhile expressed alarm at Israel's arbitrary closure of organizations and called on Israel to immediately reverse these decisions, reiterating the High Commissioner's call to revoke the designations of the organizations as terrorist and unlawful. The Israeli regime has added to its illegal practices which aim to silence the Palestinian people. Today, not only does it continue to suppress Palestinian people, the regime also quells these organizations and human rights advocates. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Iranian Minister for Roads and Urban Development Rustam Qasimi, along with the delegation of 57 dignitaries from Iran, visited Islamabad on the sidelines of 21st session of Pak-Iran Joint Economic Commission. During the two-day visit, the Iranian delegation met Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari and discussed